Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to tonight's February 23rd, 2015 edition of the Heretics Hour. I'm Carolyn Yeager, your host. There's so many stories that I would enjoy commenting on that come up all during the week. But then by the time this program rolls around, I've got a topic and I've got so much to bring forth on it that I don't have time to do these stories. But I'm going to mention a couple of them. But I've been following the Greece Eurozone news and commented on it at times, and I'm still hoping that Greece will end up leaving the Euro. I'm hoping that they will have to, but I know they don't want to, and they'll try to stick it out, and the other countries will try to help them out too, unless they're real recalcitrant about what they're willing to do. So it probably won't happen, but they want to blame Germany for their difficulties and for giving them too much austerity, which hasn't worked for them and so on, which just shows that they're children. The Greeks are really still very much children, that they need to put the blame on somebody else and like their strict parents. And if they have not grown up yet, well, they're not going to, in my opinion. They're just not. But there was a story that really showed this wasn't written by Greeks, but by somebody at Bloomberg View, and it just shows anti-Germanism on display. Yeah, I thought when I saw it, and it made me angry too, because there's this constant attack on Germans, because it's kind of like when the leader of the only one who can stand up and do things right is there, then all the people who can't, they want to pick on that one. And this is also a Jewish thing. So Bloomberg View, this is an opinion piece that came out on the 20th, February 20th, 3 days ago, by someone named Mark Gilbert. Now, I can't tell if he's Jewish or from his picture if he is, but anyway, he writes about the Schauble was saying that they weren't going to bend any for Greece, and people were shocked to hear that. They weren't going to go out of their way to accommodate them. So this person writes, yesterday's astonishing sequence of events, Greece requesting a six-month extension and the European Union declaring that a basis for negotiation, or I never can read that right, the European Union declaring that request by Greece was a basis for a negotiation. Now, what does the European Union have to do with it? This is a Eurozone affair amongst the Eurozone nations, and the European Union is just so liberal and just ready to spend Germany's money all the time. So they're saying that was a good basis for negotiation. But the German finance ministry trashed the idea as a Trojan horse, and he thought that was unbecoming of a project as grand as the Euro, especially at such a critical juncture. It doesn't help that much of what passes for negotiation is being conducted via leaks and so on, he says. Okay. Then he says, Germany's peers need to remind Finance Minister Wolfgang Schauble that they too have skin in the game. Germany may have the loudest voice in the Euro project and have paid the most into the bailout package currently keeping Greece afloat. But that doesn't give it the exclusive right to play the bouncer at Europe's party. See, now that's what made me angry when I read that. And when I read the headline, when I saw the headline, that's why I read the story, because I saw the headline and I forgot to give you the headline. Take Europe's keys away from Germany. I had a question mark at the end. Should Europe's keys be taken away from Germany? And he thought, yes, they should be. Now that, you know, that's what made me do a double take and read the article. And his point is this, that Germany's being too tough on Greece. He goes on to say that both Greece and Germany share blame for the current mess. Why does Germany share any blame for it? They don't. They don't. It's Greece's mess. Greek politicians have been utterly naive in playing to their domestic gallery, at times acting as if they are still campaigning in a local election. Well, that's true about them. I agree with that. Germany, though, doesn't seem to have budged one inch in its demands that the new administration effectively abandon its election promises. Well, that's a joke. It's election promises? Who told these Greeks, these Syriza party people, to make promises to get elected that they couldn't no way ensure that they could no way carry out? They made promises that they were going to do something that they couldn't do, and it's now been proven that they can't do it, and they haven't done it, and they're not going to do it. So now it's up to them and their electorate, but I suppose they'll be forgiven, and they'll find more ways to blame Germany for it, right? Because these people think they should have a free ride, and they shouldn't have to suffer. Somebody else should pay their bills for them when they get in trouble, which they will always do as long as somebody's paying their bills for them. So, why should Germany budge? Why should they budge if they're in the right? And this is going to come up in tonight's program. If they're in the right and Greece is in the wrong, why should Germany budge and make more excuses or make it easier from what the change the rules from what they had been? No, they shouldn't. So it's wrong to say that you always have to take a negotiating position. You always have to be willing to adjust your position. You don't have to be willing to adjust your position. If you're the one who needs what the other one has, yeah, you probably do have to do that. But if you're the one that's in the having seat, no, you don't. So this writer goes on to say Germany has reached a point. Well, they says that the Malta finance minister said at the time that Germany had reached a point where they will tell Greece, if you really want to leave, leave. Boy, I like that. You know, I like that very much. But for some reason, they all think that it would be so upsetting to their whole system and to Europe if Greece leaves the euro and they have to make adjustments and so on. So they don't want that to happen. The next part of this that has any interest for me is, he writes, preparing for the worst is a sensible precaution as the euro crisis approaches its own version of the Lehman moment when the 2008 collapse of Lehman Brothers signaled that the credit crunch could inflict an existential trauma on global finance. Capital controls, though, would be an admission of defeat by the Greek government, which would likely prefer to quit the euro than traumatize its citizens by locking the doors of its banks. Well, I got caught in that Lehman Brothers collapse in 2008. Not that I knew anything about it, but I was invested in a fund that had a whole lot of invested in Lehman Brothers, and I didn't know that because I wasn't, you know, looking at it that closely. And when that happened, and then I got notifications, and I had quite an amount of money that was possibly going to be lost, and I was quite upset about it, I can tell you. But this fund, they worked hard to sell everything they could, and I was paid back in two or three different installments over a period of time. Almost everything that I had in there, except for about $1,500 that is still credited on my account, which I don't think I'm ever going to get because it's been years now, and they don't seem to be making any effort. I guess they're taking it that they made all the effort they can, and I don't know what kind of miracle would have to happen. But I was just glad I got most of it, and so there's this $1,500 I'm out because they allowed the global financial community was not allowing any bank to collapse, but suddenly they allowed Lehman to collapse. Not that I have any sympathy for Lehman or for any of them, but it collapsed, and people took whatever kind of losses they got from it. You know, it's a similar situation now is all. So and then it says that the euro's finance ministers gather later today. Countries other than Germany need to make themselves heard with ideas for reconciling Greece's democratic mandate for change with integrity of the existing bailout rules. Now here, what does Greece's democratic mandate for change have to do with it? You see, this guy's writing like, we have to listen to the Greek people who are saying, we want to change this. And so the Eurozone has to cooperate with that in order to respond to what these people want. They don't make the rules there. They voted for this party because this party said, we're going to get you out from under this and we're going to make all these changes. And now they're expecting them, but it's not up to the Euro banks to respond to that because the Greek people voted for it. So, and then he says it's probably too much to hope for. That's true. A musketeer spirit of all for one and one for all. Now, this is important to tonight's program. All for one and one for all. Well, yeah, when you've got the big and you've got the small, and you cannot say, see, the musketeers were three people who were somewhat equal in their abilities, I guess, and they said, okay, we're going to be all for one and one for all. We're going to go forth and fight whatever it is they were fighting for. But you don't put together a whole lot of separate elements, some very, very different in what they can accomplish and what they contribute and so on, and say all for one and one for all. That's what's wrong with Eurozone, because they want to make it that so that it won't fail. That means the strongest one, which is Germany, ends up paying for everybody. That's what it means. And God forbid that it keeps going and gets to that point. I hope it all falls apart first. Let's see if there's anything else here. Well, this Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, a former French president, and one of the key architects of the European Unification Project, says Greece needs to leave the euro because its economy needs a weaker currency to recuperate. Well, it's true. Greece cannot compete in the euro. It just can't, and I don't know why people don't accept that. I think they're ready to accept it, but there are those who want to put it off and prevent it. And then this stupid writer says, he may be correct, but that's something for Greece to decide for itself, not for its colleagues to impose, and certainly not for Germany to dictate. That's how he ends it. See, bad, bad Germany. It's not up to Greece. Greece can decide, sure, we're going to try to stay in or we're going to get out. They can decide to get out. But if they decide they want to stay in, they have to follow the rules. And the colleagues impose these rules. And certainly Germany has more to say about it than any other country. And everybody recognizes that. And that is why this time you didn't hear any different opinion from anybody in the Eurozone on this Greek issue, which I'm sure that's what finally made the Greeks realize that they better get off their high horse and go along with the program, because they didn't have any supporters. Not one of the other countries, even the small countries, defended them or stood up for them. Everybody knows the truth about all this finally, and I think this shows that they're realizing they don't want to get out from under the help of Germany and the connection with Germany. They know they need that because they can't even do as well as they're doing on their own without it, without Germany being what they call the engine of financial and exporting goods, manufacturing engine of Europe. So they're realizing that. There might be some hope there for that if that continues. All right, and I saw a little story right before the show, about an hour ago, and it sort of fits, I think, with tonight's program, so I'll briefly mention it. It's a story that just appeared on the news feed about Stephen Hawking, and I guess that a movie about him won the Best Actor Award at the Academy Awards last night. And he had set up a tour of his museum, is it, or some museum, with somebody who won the competition of sending in questions to him. It's all a big publicity thing. So there he is, and you know Stephen Hawking is, well, he's got this disease. He's in a wheelchair, and he's all deformed, and his face is deformed kind of, and I think he talks kind of funny. Is he the one that talks through a kind of a talk box, or he doesn't talk too well, probably weak lungs. And he's what you call paraplegic or something like that. Yeah, paraplegic. And he's a physicist or something like that. And so the person who won this tour of this museum with Stephen Hawking was a 24-year-old African from California with an African name, Diaz something. Stephen Hawking's comments were, at the question that she asked him, see, she got to ask him a question, but his answer was, The human failing I would most like to correct is aggression. And he goes on to say, it may have had survival advantage in caveman days to get more food, territory, or partner with whom to reproduce, but now it threatens to destroy us all. A major nuclear war could be the end of civilization and possibly the human race, he said. The quality I would most like to magnify is empathy. It brings us together in a peaceful, loving state, he added. Well, naturally, he would have ideas like that. Look at him. How's he going to do anything different? And that's what he wants from other people. But is this what's going to bring about peaceful, loving state in the world? To focus on empathy with all peoples of the world and all human beings and so on, and get rid of any of our aggression. Well, we'll see as we go through tonight's program. I certainly didn't react too well to that article either. And as usual, I have a topic which was Hitler's Road to Resurgence paper that he prepared for Emil Kierdorf in 1927. This came up back in October when I was having a disagreement over it with Wolf Wall Street, also known as Bob from D.C. He had said some things that I thought were totally wrong and misinterpreting and misleading people about Adolf Hitler. But I always said I was going to do more on this paper. I was going to go through it more carefully and I was going to discuss it. Well, I never got around to it, but I finally have. Something caused me to be attracted to it again. So I have read it very carefully. And at the time, Wolf Wall Street was saying that it was Hitler's first mistake. You know, he thinks Hitler made some serious mistakes, and this was the first mistake. Tom Metzger, who he is associated with and used to be even more closely associated with as kind of his mentor, also agrees with that, and they have it on there. It's on the website. I don't even know whose website it is, but I think Bob says it's his. It's War, W-A-R, and it's Hitler. They consider it Hitler's first mistake, and it reads so well. And trying to figure out why it's a mistake, Bob finally admitted that he could only say it was a mistake because it was secret. And who was it secret from? Well, it was secret from the people in his party who were more on the left. And I don't know if it was secret from them, but it was secret from the working people. He didn't show it to them. He wrote this for this industrialist who liked his political philosophy very much. This was a very influential man, Kierdorf, and very wealthy. And he asked Hitler. He had already indicated how much he liked Hitler's ideas, but he asked for a paper for Hitler to write something that he could show to the other his other industrialist friends to try to convince them to go on Hitler's side too, because they were all hesitant because of the socialist thing, not the nationalist. And Kierdorf was a great nationalist, but that's why I'm going to be going more depth into the Road to Resurgence than the other items that I have here. What I want to do is to clarify Adolf Hitler's emphasis on race as it pertains to Germans. And this kind of fits in with my criticisms and disagreements with Veronica Clark also, and I don't really want to bring her up too much, but she does play a role here, or her ideas that I think are very bad, along with Bob's ideas. I want to clear up more than I've done already. I've already worked at that, but I do a little bit more. And show whether Hitler was tolerant, how tolerant Hitler felt it was important to be, and was he, or how he viewed tolerance. So we're going to go into that whole thing about tolerance. You know, and then remember that in the last few weeks I've been discussing the Jewish input, the Jewish efforts to force a whole group of laws onto Europe that made tolerance mandatory. They want Europe to have laws against intolerance. So this whole thing about tolerance has become very, very important. And as I said in my show announcement, that it has become enshrined in academia now. And when I was growing up, some schools would have the word truth somewhere in their entrance to their school and so on. And this, you know, this is what was being represented as the ideal of the academic life, to discover truth. And I think now that would not be so, because if the truth doesn't fit in with the idea of tolerance, or if the people think it's not being tolerant, it won't be allowed, because tolerance is now the highest ideal to be achieved, not only also in our educational institutions, they're promoting tolerance above everything else, but also in society, and of course throughout the media and so on. So it's very important to tackle this whole idea of tolerance, in my opinion it is. And I already talked about the road to resurgence, and I'll also bring up Operation Hummingbird, which was also known as the Rome Putsch, which took place in 1934, which is the result, according to Wolf Wall Street, of Adolf Hitler's turn to the wealthy class, the industrialists, and courting them, which is what he finds at fault in this paper. So we'll look at all this, and whether what Adolf Hitler did led to success or not. And if Hitler did not do what he did, what success would have come from Hitler joining with Stalin, which these leftists within his party thought was the right way to go, to join with German-Russian unity or federation. Well, we'll get into that. Or is it even just pitting the working class with the industrial managerial class? Was that something he should have done? That's what they thought. Let's just stand for the working class against the industrial managerial class. And where would that have led if Hitler had done that? Well, I say here it leads to mediocrity. That's where it would have led, because that's where it always leads. Adolf Hitler insists on the importance of the merit of race, we're going to find. He's very strong on the merit of race and the outstanding individual personality that race produces. A number of outstanding individual personalities that the race produces, but if there's one in any particular time, that is a person that should be leading, and that is a person that should be recognized. And communism, Bolshevism, whatever way you want to present it, even if it's just leftism or left-wingism, or there's lots of names people try to put on it now to kind of cover it up, is raceless. It's raceless, and it's open to all. Well, that's a big difference between Hitler and that, because Hitler believes, we're going to see, and never changes that belief, that at bottom, the race of the people is what matters. So what we have now, this is what we have now. We have this raceless way of thinking, raceless way of life, and political power. That type of politics is in power now because of the defeat of Hitler and the triumph of the anti-racists, no matter what name you want to call them. You know, they're called by a lot of different names, but all people on the left are anti-racist. Basically, you know, you can't get away from that. And what this also unites them, anti-racism unites these people, because I think the investigation of that question, racism and racialism, leads you to the importance of race. That is, one race, and it becomes one race over another, superior and lesser races, but they don't want to deal with race because they want to deal with class. So therefore, race cannot possibly matter. And that to me is the crux of the thing right there. So let's see how all this fits together with tolerance. All right, looking at the meaning of tolerance, it's, as a noun, it's the capacity for or the practice of recognizing and respecting the beliefs or practices of others. The thing about tolerance is that it sounds so good to our ears, because it sounds like fairness, and we're used to hearing it. It's been promoted for a long, long time. It wasn't after Hitler was, after 1945, that it began to be promoted, but the form of it now is, I would say, comes from that period. So the practice of recognizing and respecting the beliefs or practices of others. Well, why not? Okay. But if you're in the same country or you're in the same location or you're in the same house or whatever, now how do you recognize or respect the beliefs and practices of others, as well as your own, carrying out your own practices? It's the word practices that is kind of makes it even more difficult there. But that's what it calls for. It's a fair, another definition, a fair, objective, and permissive attitude toward those whose opinions, beliefs, practices, racial or ethnic origins, etc., differ from one's own. In other words, freedom from bigotry. So tolerance is a permissive attitude, supposedly objective, about those whose ideas differ from your own. Okay, variations on that. Then we find some synonyms for tolerance: patience, sufferance, forbearance, liberality, impartiality, open-mindedness. Now I will say that these things all can work well in rather unimportant situations, like if you're in your everyday friendships, in your relations with people on the job or in the neighborhood, but too much, sometimes you can't forbear that much. But in any case, you know, if it's not important, but if we're talking about the government of our nation and, well, further on, the lives of, well, the makeup of our neighborhoods and the makeup of our government and the so on, then we come up with some, where this is not just so easy to just say, well, let everybody do what they want and I'll do what I want. It's kind of the live and let live attitude. And then tolerance is agreeing in allowing the right of something that one does not approve of. Here we're getting into a little bit more nitty gritty. So you have to allow somebody to do things that you don't approve of. And they are supposed to in turn allow you to do what they don't approve of. If it's minor things, again, it's not too much of a problem. But if it gets into more decisive things about your beliefs and so on, then it can be more serious. And tolerance suggests a liberal spirit toward the views and actions of others, tolerance toward religious minorities. Toleration implies the allowance of, or sufferance of, conduct with which one is not in accord, like toleration of graft. Well, we'll let the graft go on because, well, we have to be tolerant, I guess, huh? Well, that's kind of questionable that they use that, isn't it? I'm going to move on here. I'm going to say that a follower of my work and my website and programs, and he's a follower of others too, Blut und Boden recommended just the other day some pages in Mein Kampf about race and tolerance, because we were discussing that on the website. So I thought it was very good. It's a selection beginning on page 309 in Mein Kampf, translated by Murphy, is what he used. And he's got it on a PDF, the entire Murphy translation of Mein Kampf. But this is starting on page 309, Hitler. I'm going to compare some of the things that Hitler has said. And, of course, Mein Kampf, we go back to 1925. So in 1925, he wrote this: "No man can tell if what many blinded pacifists hope to attain by petitioning, whining and crying may not have been reached in this way, namely a peace which would not be based upon the waving of olive branches in tearful misery mongering of pacifist old women, but a peace that would be guaranteed by the triumphant sword of a people endowed with the power to master the world and administer it in the service of a higher civilization." I thought that was important there, a piece not of this crying, tearful waving of olive branches or whatever, because you can't stand a fight, But guaranteeing it by the triumph of the sword, by using the sword, by winning the fight, by a people endowed with the power to master the world and administer it in the service of a higher civilization. This is the kind of thinking that Adolf Hitler had, not the kind that is being carried out today by Merkel and Hollande, the French president. Is he the president? I think that's his title. And they're trying to find peace with Russia over Ukraine, and they're failing all the time because they're such wimpy people. And Russia and Putin knows that they're afraid to go to war, that nobody wants to go to war. And when you're afraid to do it, well, somebody's going to just keep pushing the button because they're going to come out ahead. So this is what Hitler said. No, you have to have a strong enough people in charge who can, and a just and good enough people who can win the war and therefore win the peace and therefore administer in the service of higher civilization, which is what he had in mind for the Germans to be doing. And what I would say only in Europe, only the Germans can do. The Germans today, well, no, because they're not prepared to think that way. But if they were thinking that way, which they were doing in the 1930s and 40s, then they are the only ones to do it. And if it's going to be done in the future, it'll have to be the Germans doing it. Thus, for the first time, a high inner purpose is accredited to the state. In face of the ridiculous phrase that the state should do no more than act as the guardian of public order and tranquility, think about that. The purpose of the state is just to keep public order and tranquility and let people do whatever they wish to do. That's our liberal societies today. So that everybody can peacefully dupe everybody else, Hitler says. It is given a very high mission indeed to preserve and encourage the highest type of humanity, which a beneficent creator has bestowed on this earth. So another goal is to encourage a higher type of humanity, the highest you can accomplish in the times that you're living. Out of a dead mechanism, which claims to be an end in itself, a living organism shall arise, which has to serve one purpose exclusively, and that indeed a purpose which belongs to a higher order of ideas. So you see what he's getting at there. And he says, as a state, the German Reich shall include all Germans. Its task is not only to gather in and foster the most valuable sections of our people, but to lead them slowly and surely to a dominant position in the world because it is the main expression of our common will to exist. What I think is important here is that he's not behaving like the Europeans want everyone to behave now and Germany to behave now, but he is saying that our task is to lead and take on a dominant position in the world because we have we're the right ones to do it, and that the main expression has to be our common will to exist. Now he brings this out again in some other things, that it's absolutely vital that a people has a common will to exist, or sometimes it's put a common will to survive. If you don't have that, if you don't think that you should survive over and above anybody who would be obstructing your existence or survival, then you're going to fail. And he doesn't see this as anything wrong with this. He sees this as good and necessary, the way it should be, that a good people and a strong people has this will for themselves to exist. Of course, he talks about struggle all the time and the struggle that nature shows us, the example of continual struggle to exist. And this shows it's right for people to struggle to exist. And you struggle against other people who are struggling with you. If there's a question over land or whatever, you have to, you struggle over it. If you need that, I'm not just saying, he wasn't saying if you want it, but if you need it to exist, if you need it for your people to continue, then you have to go after it. And if somebody fights you for it, well then, you fight for it. And this, you have to have that belief in yourself. The thing that we have today and what we've been brought to, and I used to think this myself, so I know it's how real it is that we tend to think now to be good and kind and this tolerant thing, that it's not important that we live. It's not important that that our nationality or our group of people or our family continues or our race continues in this world, because somebody else will be here and somebody else is as good as we are, and we shouldn't fight over things because they need it too. And if they need it, well, maybe the better man would just let them have it. And, you know, the good man would let the other have it and do without himself. If his group, tribe, or people ends up ceasing to exist, well, so what? And this Hitler was very, very clear about. But that attitude is pathetic, and he has no respect for it whatsoever. And the only way to be, and the only thing that he would respect, is to fight for your people and to fight for your people's existence and to seek that out first. And he says that he likes the proverb that victory will always be won by him who attacks, not by him who waits to be attacked or who's only prepared to defend. So we can see that going on in the Ukraine too. For us, another little sentence I took down from these two pages, and the last one here, he says, for us, meaning the state, he's always speaking for the state, the German state at this time, his conception of the state. So his conception of the state is an effective weapon in the service of a great and eternal struggle for existence, a weapon which everyone must adopt. Some people might think that Hitler is too hung up on the struggle for existence, that we don't have to live that way. Of course, he didn't have an easy childhood. He had a happy one, but it wasn't easy. He lost his parents young when he was left with be on his own, and then he had troubles with getting the kind of schooling he wanted to get. He thought he could go to art school and find out he couldn't because he didn't have the prerequisites for it. And then he thought he would just teach himself, and for several years he worked at the same time he worked at his art, and he was studying architecture and so on. He thought he would learn everything he needed to learn, and then he would be accepted. And then the war came along, so he was happy to join the war and fight for Germany, and he got older and his ideas developed. And he saw what it was like, and then when Germany gave up at the end, and that's how he sees it, that's too simple, but gave up and let it go, that made a huge impression on him. And then he realized at that point that for Germany to survive and to continue on, it needed a whole different philosophy, and it needed to struggle for its existence, and it needed a good leadership, a totally different kind of leadership. And he made the decision that he would see that happened, and that he would do that. And then he struggled all those years to build up the party. So he had to come from ignominy and move himself up the hard way. So he's very familiar with that and what it takes. And I think even if for people who didn't have those same experiences, I think we can see from the state that our race is in today that he was absolutely right. And that if we were not struggling, if we were letting go and giving way all these years, that's why we're in the shape we're in today. And we're too afraid now to demand anything for ourselves. And we're told we're selfish and so on, and we've just lost all kinds of ground. Well, I'm looking for where I'm going to skip a whole bunch of stuff I've got here, which I figured I probably would do. And, well, I've got one more quote here from Hitler, I guess from the Mein Kampf, saying, if I'm convinced something is true and correct, I have not only, I don't know where this is from, but it's something I like that he says, and he says it quite often. If I'm convinced something is true and correct, I have not only the duty to convince others of that, but also the responsibility and duty to stamp out its opposite, to destroy or uproot it. Therefore, I don't know when Hitler first put this idea together, but it's consistent throughout the rest of his life and service, and he says that on other occasions. And I think this is one of the more impressive things that nobody else ever has ever said, that I've never heard him say it, that if he believes that what he has come up with is true, and he had very strong, he was never hesitant about things, you know. I mean, he worked it out until he was certain that he was on the right course. And if he believed it was really the right course, not just a personal course, but the right course for Germany, that he not only had the job to convince others that it was the right course, but also to stamp out the opposite, to destroy it, to get rid of it. And this is what people find so intolerant. This goes absolutely against the whole idea of what tolerance is. Oh my gosh, you're not going to let other people have their point of view. This is what is behind his getting rid of all the other political parties in Germany once he took power, and his party was the only party then, because his party was the right party, was on the right track, and it would only be damaging and put a hindrance on the accomplishments for Germany to allow other parties to be there and trying to convince people of their views. So here, this is why Hitler's not a Democrat, and he would not support the idea of tolerance. Now I'm going to move to just a couple years in the future, to from 1925 to 1927, to this time when Hitler wrote this pamphlet, Road to Resurgence, for Emil Kierdorf. Before I get into Road to Resurgence, but I don't want to say too much about other people. So I just say that, you know, Bob from D.C. is a proponent, he says, of a fourth position. Fourth position is kind of hard to pin down. I don't even find a definition of it on his site. But the Fourth International, on Wikipedia, it says that the Fourth International, which I think was the fourth position comes from, is the Communist International Organization consisting of followers of Leon Trotsky, or Trotskyists, with the declared dedicated goal of helping the working class bring about socialism. The Fourth International was established in France in 1938. Trotsky and his supporters, having been expelled from the Soviet Union, considered the Comintern, or Third International, to have become lost to Stalinism and incapable of leading the international working class to political power. Thus, Trotskyists founded their own competing Fourth International. And fourth political theory is beyond left and right. See, all this describes Tom Metzger and Wolf Wall Street, Bob D.C. Basically, it's working class. It's always, we got to help. We don't want to betray the working class. And his complaint about Hitler is that Hitler betrayed the working class. And so that's Tom's complaint, too. And when they did that and so on, so I really probably need to get right into that. But it's based on this idea that there's something better, that if you're on the right, the far right, you might have more in common with the far left, and what you don't like is the center, which is, again, the bourgeoisie, or doesn't have to be that, but the moneyed class. You're against the moneyed class because no matter what they might say, they're going to screw you, and they're not going to look out after your interests. So it is the class consciousness of pure socialism and communism that is behind that, that supports these fourth position ideas. So I'm going to have to read The Road to Resurgence that Hitler wrote to see if he is actually selling the workers out to the industrialists. And this is translated, but then I thought, well, who translated this, you know, because Hitler wrote this in German, and all I see is English, but it was translated by a woman named Adrienne Gottwald. Adrienne Gottwald, German name. And this is from Henry Ashby Turner, Jr., who published this with a lot of editorial comments of his own. And Henry Ashby Turner is the one who also put out the book Hitler Memoirs of a Confidant, which Veronica Clark keeps referring to. And, you know, I mentioned last week that in her book with the Platterhoff speech and the Himmler speech together, that she, in her foreword, she had used a quote from Adolf Hitler that actually was from Otto Wagner, who is, did I mention his name yet? Henry Ashby Turner, Jr., put out the memoirs of Otto Wagner, but makes it appear on the book, because you don't see Otto Wagner's name anywhere till you get in way inside of it, that it's Hitler's memoirs. And Veronica Clark is actually, she knows better, but she's actually quoting from this book and from Otto Wagner, as though it is Hitler. And I pointed that out last week about that quote she put in that book. And now I find that she's still doing it. Either she didn't read what I wrote or she doesn't care. Maybe that's why she's still doing it. But recently, I was going to talk about this, but I'm not going to. And I don't have time to. But Fritz Berg did a program with John Friend. And there's been, and of course, every time that happens, Clark gets in on it. And he brings her in on it. So there's some comments by Veronica Clark following that on that program post at John Friend's blog. And the two recent ones she just put on are, she quotes Adolf Hitler. And the source of the quote is this Memoirs of a Confidant by Henry Ashby Turner. And she knows this is not Hitler's words, but she feels that Otto Wagner's memory of what Hitler said when he was in his presence and associating with him from 1929 to 1932 is good enough. And however Otto Wagner remembers that what Hitler said, she is quoting it as Adolf Hitler. So on this comment she wrote for February 22nd, 2015 at 10 p.m., she says, Adolf Hitler said, and then she puts this whole quote down here, and she says the source is this Henry Ashby Turner book, but it's not Hitler, it's Otto Wagner. And up above, she has another one following, this one is following Fritz Berg's comment at the very bottom right now, and up above, after Nick Dean made some comments, she responded to Nick Dean with another Adolf Hitler quote from the same source. And she says, Adolf Hitler, blah, blah. And then Adolf Hitler said, and then she put some more of it. And it all comes from the same Ashby Turner book, which is Otto Wagner's memoirs. Not Hitler memoirs, but it says Amazon.com, Hitler-memoirs.confidant.henryashbyturner. See how people do this. And other people don't know any better. And they think that in spite of all the things they know about Veronica Clark, they'll still think that she's going to be on the up and up about things like this. But clearly, she's not. She's not. And neither is Wolf Wall Street, and neither is even Tom Metzger. I don't know. I can't say that about Tom Metzger. I don't know what he said about it. But I know that he thinks that Hitler made all these mistakes because he's not didn't go along with the left wing of his party, which he supposedly, according to them, said he was going to do, and then he changed his mind or whatever. Anyway, in this paper that Hitler wrote to for Emil Kierdorf, and who was going to show it to all the industrialists to give the idea of what his program was, his economic program, and his attitude toward socialism and so on, because they were worried that he was a socialist and they didn't want socialism. So Hitler wrote this, and I think it conveys, I think Hitler gave his real and sincere views and policies that he was going to carry out. I don't think he was playing up to these men at all. it is the real Hitler speaking, and he did do what he said he was going to do, and none of it is a problem. What it points out, I mean, what it shows is that he had the same views, that race was very important, and the race had to remain intact and what he would call pure, and it was also important to the folk was important, and the struggle was important, and a few other things. So I'll just try to go through this pretty fast. Indeed, you talk about a resurgence of our folk. Indeed, the enthusiastic concurrence of thousands of my listeners in his speeches has taught me again and again that wherever our race and kind has remained pure, understanding has also stayed alive for the great German heritage, which has been entrusted to and obligates all of us. Another thing I want to point out is that everything about Hitler was German. Everything was about Germany. He never indicated that he was becoming an internationalist, although he wanted Germany and Germans to administer Europe for the good of all of Europe, for the good of all. But he wasn't saying, well, we'll join, they'll join with us and we'll all do it together. He didn't put it that way because he didn't trust that it could be accomplished that way. He thought he understood and could work with his German people, and he couldn't do the same with all these other people, so he couldn't bring them in and trust that they would do things right. So he says that they're working for the inward and outward resurgence of our folk, and he gives them a German salute, and he unites with them, you know, as a German. And he says then, at a time when one part of the nation is indulging in completely unfounded optimism, while the other, unfortunately not the worst, has lost all courage and sees no hope whatsoever, I want to attempt to describe the present situation as I see it and point out the path which I am unshakably convinced can alone lead to salvation. To begin my reflections, I wish to explain what causes me to disassociate myself from both optimists and pessimists. Even with the most unprejudiced intentions, I cannot bring myself to view our folks' present situation as satisfactory or hopeful, or even to concede that at any time in the past 10 years, any signs whatsoever of improvement, or, as one says today, an upswing, have become evident. Even in the economic sphere, so-called consolidation is either an unthinking fallacy or a deliberate lie. Well, in 1927, Germany was a Weimar democracy and had parliamentary system of government, and they were, you know, the government changed every so often. They had their problems, but people would be hopeful that things were improving now for Germany, and this was always going on. We're used to this in democracies. Oh, the next group of people elected will do better, and they've got this plan and that plan. You know, brings to mind even the Greek election and all these elections and so on that we have here in the USA and all around in Europe. Then he makes the flat-out statement, the nation spends more than it earns. Well, that was not an okay thing for Hitler. The prescription of offsetting this imbalance by means of foreign loans does not help us resolve the dilemma. It neither affects our balance of trade fundamentally, nor does it pave the way to future recovery. Quite the contrary, the annually increasing burden of interest payments plunges us into an ever greater dependency on the outside world. In other ways, too, a significant portion of the nation's economy, of our national productivity, is falling under the impersonal control of international finance capital, while innumerable medium-sized and small livelihoods are going under. Yet not only the financial indebtedness of German industry, but also that of German agriculture is growing unremittingly. The bulk of our folk, and even business circles, may fail to recognize these dangers, but they do exist. Another 30 years of this line of development, and the German folk will have lost the greatest part of its once independent economy. So he's warning about the direction that they're going in, that it's only going to get worse. And then there's a whole paragraph here I'm not going to read, but it's about economics. And he says, talks about seasonal employment and relief payments. As these few factors, on the one hand, the loss of the nation's economic independence to, or at least controlled by, supranational international financial interests, and on the other hand, the loss of opportunities for millions of human beings, these are the most visible signs of decay and therefore the reverse of any consolidation or restoration of the German economy. There he goes into the national versus the supranational and international. And he says, outward signs should not be allowed to divert attention from the inherent weakness of our nation's economy, that a no less weighty reason for my critical view of our folks' economic life lies, in my opinion, in the loose, not to say indecent, practices which are, alas, being employed to an increasing degree in the economic activity of broad circles. Speculation and swindling can conjure up the illusion of momentary success a thousand times over, but such successes are not the expression of any inner recovery or indeed of any further advance. The following fundamental remarks should be made in this context. Since our own soil cannot possibly sustain the sum total of our population, we are forced to leave the inner circuit of our economy and adjust our production to the export market. This is that we don't have enough agricultural land. We can't sustain our food needs, and we're forced to, therefore, adjust our economy to the export market to create goods that other people want to buy so that we have then the money to buy the food we need. And he says that this is what Germany is being forced to do, and I don't know what I'm missing by not reading all this, but I don't think I can, so... Then he says, especially he talks about France and England and so on, especially in the sphere of the motorization of the world, America appears to be cornering the whole world market. He's talking about car manufacturing, automobiles. Not to overlook the fact that in importing countries, industry is also slowly beginning to develop, so that geographically less favorably situated countries, as for example Germany, will one day have to reckon with difficulties in finding markets for their products. That is, that other countries are improving their manufacturing industry, then they won't need to export, they won't need to buy Germany's goods. So they have to, thinking ahead, they have to think about that. He's, you know, how are we going to continue to survive? In addition, he says, the outside world has succeeded in breaking down a number of German monopolies on the world markets and is emerging as dangerous competition thanks to the coercive restraints of wartime and as a result of the peace treaties and the extensive industrial espionage they produced and fostered. So back to the Versailles Treaty and what it did to Germany and caused some things that it had a monopoly on. Previously it lost, and there's more competition, and there's also industrial espionage going on, which came about as a result of what the peace treaties imposed on Germany. So allowing people to come into the country and do things. Finally, however, the economies of the outside world's great industrial states are backed up by those countries' political power. So it's not just our economic power and ability, but the political power can decide a lot, and Germany doesn't have it. So he's going through more of this, the problems that Germany is facing. He says, I see even less cause for optimism in the general political development of our folk. Almost 9 years have passed since 1918, and that is a longer time than lay between October 1806 and the Battle of Leipzig. Once again, he's using everything German to refer to what he's talking about. And now, you know, here he's going to talk about the working class, the folk, the people. I do not believe in such a possibility now that we can come back. He says that the Prussian state came back from defeat in 7 years back then. But he says he doesn't think they can do that now. because on the basis of its present political and economic conduct, the German folk has no intrinsic right to hope for freedom from its from the situation that it's in. In this context, I must take a very firm stand against those who from time to time imagine they discern symptoms of a political upsurge in the vacillating game of parliamentary battles or the ever-changing outcome of elections. Actually, the fact of the matter is, the German folk is splitting ever more pronouncedly into two camps that oppose each other as mortal enemies. Well, I say now we're getting to the heart of the matter here. He says, these camps are rapidly becoming mutually exclusive and are transforming themselves into closed, self-sufficing entities, one of which the Marxist, a foreign body within its own folk, disclaims all ties to the nation so that it can ally itself with analogous bodies in other nations. Okay, one of the problems is that one of these camps is the Marxist camp, which he calls a foreign body within its own folk because it's made up of German Marxists, Germans, but they're a foreign body within their own folk because they disclaim all ties to the nation, all ties to Germany, and ally themselves with similar Marx bodies or Marxist groups in other nations. So there he's making it very clear that his idea for a strong nation is racial and nationalistic, is all Germans joined together to be strong, and not some Germans joining with groups in other countries all over the world based on class considerations. So he writes, Marxism's irrational caste-like behavior and estrangement from its own folk has a parallel only in the early history of Christianity, which also established itself as a state within the Roman state, outside the general community of interests, and thereby became the cause of the extraordinary collapse of a world empire, which no longer could muster the resistance of the whole state to counter the impact of the technologically and organizationally far inferior Teuton bands. So this is a real important part of this. First, he's saying why he doesn't like Marxism, and he doesn't want to join with the left wing and link up with the Soviet Union. It wasn't even Russia. It was Soviet Russia at that time. He is already in 1927 pointing to Christianity as a bad factor, as an alien entity in the nation that it's in, you know, as a foreign body. It was it became a foreign body in the Roman state and helped to bring down that great state, as he says. And also that the Roman state became weak because of the work of the Christians, and then the inferior Teuton bands, which certainly did not have the technology or the organization of the Romans, were able to do a lot of damage and even bring it down and invade the Roman territory. So then he goes on to say, Germany lost the World War for very similar reasons. In view of such a state of affairs, any hope for a political resurgence is purely utopian, because they have the same problem. They have a foreign body in the German state. But he says, for a true resurgence of the German nation is contingent not on the fulfillment and satisfaction of so and so many daily demands, but rather on regaining the inner strength of the nation, which lies in the universal collective awareness that its survival is essential, as well as in the sense of national unity this awareness produces. This, however, is lacking, he says. So this is also important. And remember, this is written by Hitler, no doubt about it. It's not something that has to be questioned. And he says that for Germany to come back again, to have a resurgence, it has to regain its inner strength as a nation. It has to regain the inner strength of the nation. And that lies in its collective awareness that its survival is essential. And here it comes again from what I mentioned earlier. you have to have that inner sense, and it has to be collective. All Germans must have to be aware, or at least a lot of them, most, as many as you can get, to be that the survival of Germany is essential. If the nation doesn't believe that its survival as a nation is essential, it can be defeated by others who do believe that about themselves. This is Hitler's belief. Now, you know, I cannot argue here or even know for sure whether he's right or wrong, but I'm trying to get across what Hitler did believe and what he said and thought, as opposed to what people are saying about him that is incorrect. So he goes on, the Reich and the German national body can nevertheless go on living for a time, just as a man suffering from tuberculosis does not die immediately, yet this kind of life is not synonymous with health. So you can see a country, well, it's like the United States. It goes on, it looks strong, it looks good, but it's not healthy. It can't be healthy. And so it's not going to go on. It's eventually going to succumb. It might take a while, but he's talking about a healthy nation and a sick nation. So I prefer to be counted among those who consider politics the task of paving the way of a folk to the future, to distant ages to come, of not only securing the prerequisites for survival, but also of presenting general opportunities for the formation and fullest expression of the essential nature of a folk. Otherwise, the saying, Germanness shall cure the ills of the world, has no relevance for our times. Again, for a nation to survive, it has to be conscious of itself and of the importance of its own survival. So this is it, and he is so much into caring about the folk and the German folk and the German nation. And so the idea of joining together with other countries in a class conscious thing, let's get the working class to overthrow the wealthy class and the industrial class, and we'll take over and make a better world, you know, make a utopia for all people and get rid of those nasty elites that we have. Hitler did not want to go in that direction, and he didn't. And he says that he views the task of German politics in this way. Each folk requires a certain amount of space on this earth so that its own identity may develop freely. It is the task of politics to ensure that rigid space is constantly adjusted and accommodated to a fluctuating population. He's not respecting borders that were set somewhere by someone that he doesn't think are fit the needs of the people that are living on these lands. And he says, since a folk may only be designated as healthy when it takes part in the universal struggle for survival, for which, however, the prerequisite is population increase, it must be the primary function of politics to accord this natural imperialism, and he calls it natural imperialism, its equally natural satisfaction. So if your population increases, if you have an increasing population, it's the job of politics, the function of politics, to see that you have an increasing amount of land to live on, and you have the food necessary. You can grow the food necessary for yourself. So this is what he's putting in here, making it sound quite rational and sensible. In its highest sense, politics is thus the task of making a nation strong. Well, let me say that about that before. I feel that some of these countries were given more land than they need, and they don't have a population to match it. Poland is one. Romania is another. They don't have the population or the industry or the economy to match all that land they have. And other people are crowded. Today, Germany's very crowded, because it was taken from Germany, and everything was moved kind of west to take from Germany, and so even Romania, it probably didn't take from Germany, it took from Hungary very much land, but everything has to be moved west to get their share of land. So that whole thing was wrong, and it's still wrong, in my opinion, and it ought to be corrected. So I agree with him in this. In its highest sense, politics is thus the task of making a nation's struggle for survival possible by ensuring that the basis for food production is constantly brought into line with the population count. I see that time is going by fast here, so I will have to skip a little bit. He says, to fulfill this mission, not only individuals of great stature, but also a nation firmly welded into a single common community of interests, this is what he wants, is required. The three fundamental principles must be observed in this context. The survival and the future of the various folk groups on the earth depend on 1, the merit of their own race. 2, the extent to which they accord significance to the role of the individual personality. And 3, recognition of the fact that life in this universe is synonymous with struggle. So these are his three main pillars, you might say. First, that race matters, that race makes a difference, that one race can do things that another race maybe can't or can't do as well. And when he says race, he's not talking about the three main races of black, white, and yellow. And he's talking about nationalities, really. He's talking about, he's meaning here the Germans as a race and other nations as a race, because it was a contest and a conflict between nations at that time, and there was no concern, no consideration for being anti-nationalistic like it became after 1945. Although he had his own plans for a united Europe. He wasn't stuck with the same old post-World War I nationalism. I mean, pre-World War I nationalism and post too, you might say. But then he also sees the importance of individual personality. He talks about the folk, but the folk can't lead, the folk can't make decisions, the folk can't do anything. He doesn't believe in the parliamentary process. He believes in the outstanding individual that comes out of the folk community. The folk community creates a certain number of outstanding personalities and leaders and great men and women. And they do a number of things, but there's one that would be the best one to be the leader of the nation. And that personality is very significant and necessary and important and has to be recognized. And then also recognition that life is struggle. We cannot ever forget in Hitler's world that life is a struggle. It's a constant struggle. Because other people are struggling too, and they're wanting what they want, and you want what you want, and if you're going to get what you want. This is not really like law of the jungle kind of thing. It's just a recognition that that he sees people in groups that have that are what he would call a race or nation, that have their own interests for themselves, and they're going to try to get what they want. And he does believe that the best group will win. The best people should win. The best people should win and get what they want. The others can get what make the best of it, you know. So he says, instead of raising aloft the merits of race and folk, millions of our folk pay homage to the idea of internationality. And we certainly do that today. And in the international idea, you're told that somebody else is going to look after you better than you can look after yourself. And that's the whole liberal idea, too. But I'll go on. He says, the strength and genius of the individual personality are in line with the absurd nature of democracy being set aside in favor of majority rule, which amounts to nothing more than weakness and stupidity. So democracy and majority rule is weakness and stupidity. The recognition of the individual personality or the superior individual within a collective is the strength, is genius and strength. And rather than recognize and affirm the necessity of struggle, people are preaching theories of pacifism, reconciliation among nations, and eternal peace. See, he's dismissing these things for the necessity of struggle, continual struggle. These three outrages against mankind, he means pacifism, though he was against that. Reconciliation among nations, you have to decide for yourself what he meant by that. I'm not real sure, but that you're not going to have that because you're not going to overcome the struggle. Look at how the world, I think I know what it is now, look at how the world order, they just yesterday or so, Merkel and Hollande said that Russia was violating the global order that they all put together so well, you know, that was in place. He was violating this global order. And this is exactly what Hitler is talking about, that there is no order that is not going to be challenged at times for what people consider to be good reasons in their own interests. So there's no reconciliation among nations that's going to hold together. That's what he means, I'm sure. And the idea of eternal peace, because if life is a struggle, how is there ever going to be eternal peace? And again, he looks at nature, and you see eternal peace in nature. That's a dream. The lion lies down with the lamb and stuff. That's just a fable. It doesn't happen. And there's no pacifism in nature either. So he says these three outrages against mankind, which we can recognize throughout all history as the true signs of decadence in folk groups and states, and whose most zealous propagandist is the international Jew, are the characteristic symptoms of the Marxism, which is progressively gaining a hold on our folk. I say our folk, for Marxism, while clearly defined and delineated as an organization, has, like a spiritual plague, taken hold of practically all our folk, though many are not aware of it. Now that really speaks to us today, because even then he says, well, Marxism did become very popular, and it was very big in Germany, lots of them, lots of communists there, Germans who took on that philosophy and believed in it and fought for it and so on. And he says, and now in 1927, it's taken hold of practically all our folk, though many are not aware of it. So it's like we talk today about people being totally Judaized, although they think they're anti-Jewish. But yet their lives are very Judaized. And if they really got rid of all the Jews, they would find that there's all kinds of things they depended on and thought were normal and natural that wouldn't be there anymore. Because they don't really realize just how badly infected they are. And once a folk has fallen prey, he says, to these vices, there can be no more talk of a resurgence. Now, you don't come back as long as you're indulging in these vices and think that they're normal way of life. And so, in reality, the stabilization of the existing state means only that our folk is slowly becoming accustomed to wholesale corruption and a general decline in standards. Indications of widespread degeneracy are hence innumerable and strike the eye of the attentive and upright observer from all spheres of activity. While our independent economy is being crushed and our political foundations and even the folk's natural instincts are being destroyed, our art is becoming a laughingstock, our language warped, our souls corroded, and our general culture poisoned. The dwarfishness of the political leaders, that's what he calls them, of our folk fits well into this general milieu, for it is a product of it. And for this reason, I reject the frivolous optimism shared by the mob and its present leaders. And nor can I join, he says, the ranks of the hopeless pessimists. And again, he says that it's racial merit. I have to read this whole sentence. There would be reason to give up all hope for our folk only if the first of the three preconditions to a folk's greatness and significance on this planet were missing: its racial merit. So he's saying if it wasn't for the fact that Germans are Germans and have that racial merit, because he thinks of Germans, he talks that way as race, he's using the word that way. And they always did in Germany. And when you try to pick apart at that, you have to acknowledge that. And he says if it wasn't for the racial merit, he would have no reason to have any hope for the German folk anymore, because the other two were too far gone. I would like to say the following about our folks' racial merit. To be sure, we have witnessed no end of sins committed against the body of this folk, which is called in German Volkskörper. That word is used in the Platterhoff talk also, all the way up in 1944, and back here in 1927 he was using this word. And this is a German word, but also said that it's a National Socialist word. It's the word they used. It means the body of the folk. We have witnessed, he says, no end of sins committed against the body of this folk in past decades, and constant bastardization with, in part, grossly inferior human material has caused and is causing a steady lowering of our racial niveau, particularly in our major cities. He's referring here to those Negroes that the French, the Algerian Negroes that the French brought in to the Germans after the war and kind of forced them there amongst the people, and there were some sexual issues, and there were these what they called the Rhineland bastards being born between the German women and these black Algerians. Hitler always spoke out against that in the strongest terms. And he's calling it here the bastardization with, in part, grossly inferior human material. That's what he's calling the Algerians. Grossly inferior human material. And has caused a lowering of our race, particularly in our major cities. Yet this situation has made no greater progress since the end of the war than before. To the contrary, perceptual cognizance is already beginning to set in alongside thoughtless negligence. However, I want to gauge our folks' intrinsic merit not by current manifestations of what has been, after all, but a short period of corrupt leadership, but rather by the record of our thousand-year culture, by the universal values our folk has given mankind, and by the heroism of our folk, is capable of by virtue of just this intrinsic merit. Our folk is able to pit the historical reality of the greatest conflict of all times against the muck we have today. The muck. For me, the folk which has today capitulated is still the folk of triumphant victories, capable of the most heroic sacrifice, noblest friendship and comradeship, and greatest loyalty. I cannot deny the merit of my folk, for heaven once blessed me with the good fortune to see its highest merit put to test on that field of honor where blood, not phrases, is decisive. Speaking of the great war that he was in. Since I know the German folk from that experience, I am unshakably filled with the conviction of its merit. Looking back into the history of the German past, I find that no other existing folk has given rise to more eminent men of distinction than our German folk. Be they statesmen or emperors, generals or princes of the arts and sciences, or kings in the realm of thought. Destiny has always given our folk the great minds it deserved. But there is no need to speak about the courage and natural fighting spirit of the German folk. This is testified to by a German history that for almost 2,000 years was world history. Well, do you think he is convinced that his German people are the best people? You know, do you have any doubt about that? That he thinks it'd be okay to bring in foreigners into the German nation and mix them in and so on? No, he wouldn't. And he's very strong about being partial to Germans. And there was nothing wrong with that. That was his position in trying to raise up Germany from the depths that it had fallen to, or the ashes that it had become, and to bring it back into a position of world importance. That's what he was about. And he said, you can't bring in any other races or any other nations. You can't allow the race to be changed if you're going to do that, because he thought it was the way it had to be right now. And then he says that only the education and leadership of our folk must be fundamentally altered in order to help it realize its merit as a state as well as a folk. So there's nothing wrong with the people, but the leadership is wrong. And he wanted to change that. And he wanted to then change the way that the people were being educated. So it's education and the leadership, which is exactly what they did after 1945. They got rid of all the National Socialist leaders and all the previous leadership, and they put in all new people who were always opposed, basically, to Hitler's party. They got rid of all the educational materials and all the teachers and everything in the schools, threw it all out. And when the children came to school again for the first time after that, they had no books, they had no nothing. They just had to sit there and take notes from the teacher reading from something until they got new textbooks printed up and all of those materials and so on. That's the way they did it. They didn't want any. They couldn't keep anything from National Socialist times. One may well grasp the full significance of precisely this problem's size and gravity, may recognize the full extent of the position of strength held by those who seduce our folk, as well as the sluggishness of the masses who meekly submit to their will. Still, this does not give one the right to abandon weakly all hope, but rather more than ever the obligation to resist. In these times, it is necessary to be guided by the spirit of Frederick the Great. It is not important that you live, but it is necessary that you do your duty. That's an interesting statement by Frederick the Great. And you can think of him saying that to his soldiers. And how many people could make a statement like that and actually tell their soldiers that? But he's telling them that. And that fact that Hitler likes this so much, it's not important that you live, because what's important is that your race and your folk live, but it is necessary that you do your duty. So your duty is, in this case, fight the battle or whatever, but your duty is to uphold your end of things. But whether you live or die, that is not what is most important. And that's putting things in perspective pretty well. Hitler says, our supreme duty today is not to capitulate in the face of signs of degeneracy, but to confront them heroically, not to lose heart, but to brace our backs and clench our teeth in order to profess that supreme faith which lies in the living conviction that everything created by man can also be destroyed by man, and that there is no work of the devil that cannot be broken by sacred will. That, at least, is my faith. Upon it, the National Socialist Movement was founded. And he gives another paragraph there, and then I'll read this part. He says, the movement heeds only the three most essential requirements for the future of a folk, his movement. It views folkdom and race as the supreme value. It puts its trust in esteem of the individual personality, and it instills readiness for sacrifice and a positive attitude toward struggle. So here he's repeating again those three, what I call, pillars of his movement for emphasis. Then he also says, the new movement categorically rejects any division into estates or classes, and in their place proclaims an all-embracing German outlook. Now, that's putting it real clear right there. He's letting them know that he rejects class warfare of Marxism and of the left, of the left alone, going only to the left and rejecting the right. So he says he categorically rejects any division into estates or classes within Germany. He wants to have an all-embracing German outlook, and he insisted on that from both the rich and the poor and the working class and the managerial class, and he made an awful lot of progress with that. Can't probably say that everybody just joined in wholeheartedly and was able to do that, but it worked quite well. It really worked pretty well, and that would be where you would have the discussion whether it worked or didn't work or whether that was a mistake or not. I certainly couldn't see it as a mistake. He goes on to say that this can't achieve this by Pi's teachings alone. No, it is convinced that the movement will first have to prove by its own example that such a changeover is possible, and further, that someday it will be possible to impose a general education along these lines on the nation. So again, you rely on education in the future, that when children are brought up with this belief and this education, it will be easier. You know, they accept it. Whereas when you're trying to talk to adults and changing their point of view and their thinking, it's a lot more difficult. Okay, I have to skip quite a bit here, and I think I've gotten the most important parts of this, and there's some good things he says. Here he says, the National Socialist Movement furthermore recognizes that complete incorporation of the so-called Fourth Estate into the national community is the most essential precondition to the fulfillment of this task and the establishment of a cohesive national body. Well, he's talking about the Fourth Estate being the press, what we call the media, that they need to have, the movement needs to have its complete media of its own. And that's what our people talk about now, but they don't make much progress in it. They depend on the internet. I won't comment on that because I don't have any solutions to it. But this is really long. Well, he's just going on now declaring the importance of the folk and how fine the folk are and so on. Love for the folk. This is the folk that fought out this world war and yet in the end collapsed, a victim of its inner failings and weaknesses, should not hope to expiate the blood sacrificed on a thousand battlefields or to set history straight by means of parliamentary or diplomatic double dealing. So he says these politicians currently in parliament and so on are not helping the folk, but the folk collapsed at the end of the war and became victim of its own inner failings and weaknesses. And he's not denying that. He's talking about it quite a lot here and saying that, again, it's only the racial reality of the German people that he has confidence in. But the German people at this point need a lot of improvement because they're still in a state of degeneration from all that went before. Now, he says, I think I'll just end here. He says, the organization of the military might of a folk, be it large or small, is always intimately connected with the doctrine of the value of individual personality, struggle, and patriotism. Unintentionally and unconsciously, to the extent that the official state becomes more and more corrupt in its folkish content, discredited by its personnel, and filled with pacifist cowardice, the movement and the army will draw ever closer together. That is his movement. He will draw closer together with the army the more the people fall prey to their failures. Says, in these 7 years of progressive deformation of the German national body, he's saying since 1919, the German national body has been going downhill, he says. A state within the state has slowly evolved, which ideologically as well as politically will be the Prussia of the coming era. So the state within the state that he's referring to now is his movement, his National Socialist Movement. And while the German nation has been progressively going downhill, he has evolved, taken root inside the state, and he says that he will politically, ideologically, and politically become the Prussia of the coming era, or he will succeed in becoming, putting the nation back together again and ruling it. And he ends up by saying, I believe in our victory. Well, naturally, this took longer than I hoped I could get through more. I wanted to talk more about that those who feel that this represented Hitler's first mistake, which was to reject the left and go to this centrist kind of German national position and reassure the industrialists and gain their support and have a balanced view of the nation and bring about the programs they did bring about, very successful ones. Workers' programs. He actually outlawed the trade unions, which were so communist, so under the control of communists. And he outlawed that and formed his own, well, this was after 1933, but formed his own workers' unions. It all worked out quite well, so that he had the workers having their representatives and the employers meeting together and working things out. And I don't know that there was any problem with it at all. It was very successful, and everybody I know thinks so. But speaking, though, about the Night of the Long Knives, Kierdorf was particularly worried about the views of some people in the party, such as Gregor Strasser, who was he was basically a communist, Gregor Strasser. And he was talking about how they had a need to redistribute the wealth in Germany. And Adolf Hitler reassured Kierdorf that these policies were just an attempt to gain the support of the working class in Germany and would not be implemented once he gained power. And I don't know how true that is, but it's probably something like that. He was reassuring the people like Kierdorf that they weren't going to redistribute the wealth or do any of these extreme communist measures, that even though some people in his party were talking like that, the left-wing people were talking like that, that wasn't going to happen. And so then Kierdorf asked for this pamphlet, and then Hitler wrote this pamphlet. And it says that Kierdorf and some of the other industrialists didn't like the Social Democratic Party, and they didn't like the Communist Party. And they were very impressed with Hitler's plans for how he was going to carry things out. And they joined the party and tried to persuade others to join the party. And Goering played a large role in this, too. But Kierdorf expected Hitler to remove the left-wing members of the Nazi Party, such as Gregor Strasser, Ernst Röhm, and Gottfried Feder. It didn't happen. But eventually, they decided that they had to do away with that the left-wing, represented by Gregor Strasser and Ernst Röhm, had a plot and a plan to take over the leadership of the party from Adolf Hitler, which probably was true. I think that's pretty well established that was true. So Hitler then quietly, with Heinrich Himmler and Bormann, and decided that they needed to to get rid of those men. And this is where it comes in, Hitler's view, that if you're convinced, he says, this is Hitler, one of Hitler's strong points that he makes. If I'm convinced that I am correct and right and that I'm doing the right thing for the German nation, then I not only need to try to convince others of that, but I need to wipe out the opposition to that. I need to destroy that which is working against my correct view. And this is the way he justified, I'm sure, what he did with cleansing the party of these left-wing communists, basically, who wanted to take over the leadership from him. But I'm going to go on now and mention a few things from Table Talk and from the Platterhoff speech. From Table Talk on July 1st, 1942, we have Hitler is talking. So I wanted to point out that we had 1925 and 1927. And what Hitler's beliefs were, the kind of things that he said, and so on. And now, in 1942, he's saying very much the same thing after being solely in power, very, very securely in power, and so on. He hasn't changed his mind about anything. He says that when he met this particular Liebig man, he was supposed to be an ardent nationalist. But when he met him, he was repelled by the fellow's undeniable Jewish appearance. And he says, I was nevertheless repeatedly assured that in the family tree of Freiherr, which went back very far, there was no vestige of non-Aryan ancestry. And now, by pure chance, we have found out that one of the Freiherr's ancestors, born at Frankfurt on Main in 1616, was a pure 100% Jew, one of his ancestors. And so, although more than 300 years separate the present Freiherr from his Jewish ancestors, and although with this one exception all his ancestors were pure Aryans, he nevertheless has all the unmistakable racial characteristics of the Jew. And he says, this is important now what's coming on here. He says, this confirms the opinion I have already expressed when speaking about the Englishman, Cripps, that all half-caste families, even if they have but a minute quantity of Jewish blood in their veins, produce regularly, generation by generation, at least one pure Jew. Roosevelt affords the best possible proof of the truth of this opinion. He's talking about half-castes. And Roosevelt, who both in his handling of important political issues and in his general attitude behaves like a torturous, pettifogging Jew, himself boasted recently that he had noble Jewish blood in his veins. The completely negroid appearance of his wife is also a clear indication that she too is a half-caste. So here Hitler is giving his opinion of race mixing. And he thinks that even a little bit is too much. And he's making that clear in this table talk conversation where he's just talking among his own associates. But he goes on with a little more and says, such examples should open the eyes of all reasonable people and be a warning of the menace that half-castes can be. A complete assimilation of foreign blood is not possible, and the characteristics of the foreign race inevitably continue to reappear. Our people, therefore, is only harming itself if it accepts half-castes into the Wehrmacht and thus admits them to a position of equality with pure-blooded Germans. We cannot accept the responsibility of burdening our bloodstream with the addition of further foreign elements. Exceptions in favor of half-castes must therefore be reduced to a minimum. So there's his position on that, and that should speak to Veronica Clark about her idea that he was far more accepting. And not only Veronica Clark, but now Fritz Berg is saying the same thing, which I was quite shocked to see him, to listen to him spouting Veronica Clark's nonsense about Negroes in Germany being not so bad. And there were some there, they were accepted and all this stuff. Like he said, you know, see, Fritz Berg is very anti-racist, as is Veronica. So he's become more and more so and supports her in that. So now he wants to think that any kind of racist talk is a big mistake. Then, in another section of Table Talk, Hitler is saying the 10 or 15,000 professional loafers who were lounging about Germany at the time of our assumption of power, that would have been in 33, and this is now, as I said, 42 July, and who showed no inclination to take a regular job when once German industry had started to function again, have been put into concentration camps, for it is ridiculous to try to deal by ordinary methods with muck of this kind. Now that shows that he's not tolerant. He doesn't believe in being tolerant for these poor people who have some excuse or other why they can't take a job because there was no lack of work in Germany at that time. Everybody could work and everybody was expected to work. And he said the fear of being put into a concentration camp has had a most salutary effect and greatly facilitated the industrial activity and so on. So there's that. And then here's this thing where he's speaking about Prince Ehrenberg on another occasion, and he says one of our earliest adherents, who is Prince Ehrenberg, has told me many interesting tales of pioneering days in the colonies. He was once sentenced to 12 years penal servitude and served six of them for having killed a nigger who had attacked him. And he doesn't quite approve of that. He said what Ehrenberg had said about that. But again, for those who want to think that Hitler was open to blacks being in his in the Wehrmacht or let alone in the SS or in the fact that a very few managed because of the colonies, I think, because Germany had a colony in Africa for a couple of them for a while. Managed to get in and managed that somebody took them under their wing or whatever. There was just a very few of them. Doesn't mean that Hitler had any tolerance. Let's go back to the tolerance. Any tolerance for blacks in Germany. He was totally against it. Would have been and was. And he also said this recently in Table Talk, because there's been a lot of criticism about what he says about the Slavs. And I would just like to say that in Hitler's hierarchy, number one, first were the Germans. The Germans were number one. After that were the Germanics. Number two, all Germanic peoples. After that, number three would be all Western Europeans. And after that, number four would be Eastern Europeans. And probably after Eastern Europeans would be number five, Russians. Because I'm wondering if he had a little distinction between what he called Slavs and then the Russian. He knew they were Slavic, but I think the Russians were the lowest on the totem pole. And that's the way it went. I wouldn't ever apologize for that at all. So he says, the German people have absorbed both northern and southern Austria, and the original inhabitants are still there. But they were Sorbwens, members of the basic European stock, with nothing in common with the Slavs. So here he's making a distinction between one type of European, the Sorbwens, and the Slavs. So when you hear Hitler talking about the Slavs and or the Russians in an indifferent way like this, not giving them the kind of respect you might think he should, although he might not think he's being disrespectful, but you have to understand that he uses nature as his guide. And when he looks and sees how well different groups act, behave, and defend themselves and so on, and get ahead, that's what he looks at it in that way. So now to finish up, let's go to the Platterhoff talk, and see how much I have here, because again, I just want to point out that he's saying the same thing. Platterhoff was in 1944, so we're moving from 42 to 44, a little bit ahead. And he is talking, and he says, so we're looking for abilities without regard to birth or origins. And believe me, first of all, we eliminate the whole social question for two reasons. See, now this fits in with the resurgence paper that he wrote back in 27. That of how he's going to organize the nation and how he doesn't like Marxism, is being fair to everyone, not regarding birth or origins. And that works both for the working class and works for the ownership class too, because they both could be discriminated against or the opposite. But he's saying we see them all as equal. We give them an equal chance in the beginning. And he says, first, we're building a people's community, the leadership of which will be largely derived from the people themselves. That is, an elementary knowledge of all things that move the people. In constantly allowing blood from below to come flowing through, I'm doing what the Catholic Church did through the circuitous route of celibacy. Since the priests can't have children, they were compelled to take their individual priests out of the people. That is, they couldn't just start breeding priests, and the children of priests became the new priests, which is what we have in the class society, but they had to go out to the people to find more priests. And this is why there are priests from families of lower-ranking officials, small businessmen, former farm boys, etc. This accounts for the strength of the allegedly disputatious church. I'm doing exactly the same thing, taking the offspring of the entire people, not just on the way to celibacy. I can't use that, he said. We got a laugh from that. But then he says, the entire people is sifted through, and I will gradually get a class of people in the leadership of the nation who more or less know all the problems of life from their own youth, from their own relatives, their parents, their brothers and sisters, etc., the environment. That is that all the German people are part of what makes it all work, and they're going around looking. They look everywhere, and they do not forget about the people on the bottom, the poorer people, if they're still poorer, they have every opportunity also, their children do, to move up into better positions in their German nation. And in another place, he writes about race again, and he says, thus scientific knowledge changes itself. The decisive thing is for one to make the latest state of scientific knowledge one's own and observe life's problems from that point of view. It very often happens that that which men grasp as knowledge had already been grasped instinctively by men in prehistory. But over the course of many centuries and often millennia, men lose their natural instincts, especially through unnatural racial crossings, and that only afterwards on the path to a scientific recognition can the correction of the earlier instinctive views be reestablished. Now, this brings to my mind a person who sent a comment to my website after I published about my DNA test results, and said he thanked me for it and said he thought that everybody, all white nationalist leaders and all people in our so-called movement should take this, should be tested, and they should publish the results because we should know what their racial makeup is. And I think that's true now that we live in a time of DNA knowledge and where you can be tested. And I do not believe or agree with people who say, stupid people, really stupid, who say, oh, well, these companies are owned by Jews and they lie and they make things up and you can't trust the results. That's stupid. That just wouldn't, they don't even know who you are, you know. And the testing is supposed to be on a pretty good level now, pretty accurate. So really, this is something that people should do. Then we wouldn't have to be going around guessing about people and accusing people of things and so on that can be proven. Actually, so he goes on to say that is he was talking about unnatural racial crossing. So he's again very, very concerned with who's breeding with whom, and he said this necessarily leads to the following conclusion: if I recognize, here's this line of his again, if I recognize a view to be correct, then not only do I have a duty to communicate this perception to my fellow citizens, not only do I have a duty to communicate this perception to my fellow citizens in a state, but also to eliminate contrary perceptions. He said that quite a number of times. You've come across it, and he means it, and that's a very important statement of his. He says, that may seem intolerant, but gentlemen, officers, all of life is intolerant. This is the lesson of nature. Nature is intolerant against everything that is not correct and therefore weak, in which case weaklings primarily become extinguished by themselves. Nature already eliminates in the something struggle the damaged and the weak. It says how bitches push weak puppies away and let them starve. It seems cruel to us, but they do it. And it has to be profound that they know nature tells them that that's what they need to do. It's because that weak one is going to just take away from all the others and be a problem. It is madness to imagine today that political views must be tolerant, he says. Tolerance is only understandable as a sign of inner insecurity. The moment that I am completely certain of a problem, here he says it again now, not only do I have the right to communicate the problem, or this attitude, but rather the duty to eliminate the other attitudes. See, he's saying it again. And this explains how he can eliminate certain persons in the party back at that time that I was talking about. Didn't do a very good job of talking about it, but Operation Hummingbird. And also why he could eliminate other parties because they weren't promoting the right or correct attitude and things like that. And he says, I must take a leap here to the point of view of an officer. When I say this as a politician, then I am expressing something which forms the natural basis of an officer's whole activity, since an officer can use everything except a tolerant point of view. That means that he too must recognize a problem a task, a necessity, and then he has not only the right to obey this necessity, but the duty to ruthlessly eliminate everything else. Every officer will be faced with this task in the course of his leadership. So he starts out talking about how intolerance in general life, in nature, and so on, and among animals, and how they don't practice tolerance at all, instinctively. And then he goes on to politicians and in the political world, why tolerance doesn't make any sense and it's wrong. It doesn't bring anything good. And then he goes on to the military and the officer corps, again, saying that an officer cannot use a tolerant point of view, cannot be tolerant. He must eliminate everything that doesn't obey obey the necessity that he's put forth of what must be done. And he talks about what happens if for an officer, if one of his men comes to him and says, "I refuse to do what you've ordered me to do. I won't kill anybody." Can you imagine? "But I can work in a room somewhere." Well, usually this takes place earlier, but maybe sometimes when they're in battle, all of a sudden a soldier says, "Gosh, I can't do this. I don't want to do this." Goes to his officer and says, I can't kill. I don't want to kill anybody. I can't do this anymore. Put me somewhere to do something else that's not on the, where I don't have to kill anything." And now he says, "What should that officer do?" Hitler asks, and he says, "At this point, they made the most cowardly decision that you can possibly imagine, because they're saying that if you won't fight, we will give you something else to do." But Hitler says, "You can't do this. This is bad for the whole group." He said, "Today the state relieves you, his state, the National Socialist state, relieves you of this problem that's foreign to the state." He said, "It takes a view that since life is a struggle," this is the National Socialist point of view that is in charge of the state of Germany, "it takes a view that since life is a struggle, an eternal struggle, a principle which every officer must adopt as his own, otherwise he can't be an officer, a man who doesn't want to shoot is unfit to live, is therefore eliminated. The officer, despite the pre-selection, which on the grounds of our worldview can isolate or destroy the man who refuses to shoot on ideological grounds, can also find himself in the same situation over the course of the struggle. That means a time may come when the coward, like any other ulcer, suddenly begins the inner poisoning of others. And at this point, the officer, for his part, finds himself faced with the same problem all over again." That is, if you let one soldier get away with it, say, "Okay, go and do this instead. We'll send you somewhere else." Then you're going to find, Hitler says, "Well, that's going to spread. Other people are going to find out about it. They don't want to fight. They don't want to stay in the fight, in the battle. So they're going to come to you with the same thing and expect the same result. And then you're going to really have a problem." So he's saying you have to stamp that out right there with the first one. And that was a philosophy of the SS, that when any member broke one of their rules, that was considered a serious rule, and they knew that they would be executed if they did. And when the few of them were discovered having done that, they were executed, which seems to me, even, I don't like it, as a harsh, too harsh for these good men, because of something, you know, they should have been harshly punished but not executed. But they did execute them, and that was because to set an example, so nobody else would do it, because they felt this is very, very important. And that's why the German fighting corps, was so disciplined and was the best in the world. People want to dispute that and accuse them of all kinds of things, but it was not true. And now we go on finally to Hitler saying again, once again, there is no tolerance in nature. Nature, I'll just skip that part, is the most intolerant thing that exists. It destroys everything that is unfit for life. But when people hear that, you know, it's been commonly said that Nazism considered this, that, and the other people unfit for life. And all these people were unfit for life, and they killed them. Actually, they didn't kill all the people, but he's saying that nature does do that. Nature destroys everything that's unfit for life, and it does. There's nobody taking care of these creatures that can't fend for themselves or aren't, you know, something wrong with them, and they can't, unless some kindly rescue society comes along and finds them and takes them to a shelter, you know, an animal safety place or whatever, and looks after them. Otherwise, they're going to have a rather, maybe not a very pleasant death. And Hitler goes on to say that man is nothing more than a small bacteria or a little bacillus on such a planet as this. Because he says, whoever is not willing to defend it, whatever is not willing to defend itself or unable to do so, is destroyed. And we are only this little speck here. And when a creature attempts to escape these laws, it doesn't change the laws, rather it ends its existence. I therefore introduce this principle into the political life of Germany. It's not new, since Bolshevism has long possessed these laws. But even Christianity has possessed this knowledge. He says, I must point out to you, gentlemen, it is not an unchristian principle, that which I represent here. Christendom destroyed other people who did not wish to think in the prescribed way. That was true. It did. And yet, you see how different people and different organizations and so on are given a reputation by the media and by the power, the governmental, by the political power, as how they want people to perceive it, not how it actually was. So Hitler is saying, I'm not the first person to think this way, that the Christians started out this way, or the Charlemagne, that once it became a church, they decided that they had to rule and they had to destroy everybody who wouldn't switch over to the Christian religion. And the Bolsheviks did the same thing for themselves. So he says, our own movement has been accused of being completely intolerant. But precisely because of this, because it obeyed a law of nature, it succeeded in achieving total victory in only 15 years, although the point of departure was as unpromising as it could possibly be. So he thinks that that has served him well, and he became the leader of Germany because of it. Now, just to end this, I'm at the end here, but just to tie in and mention that why I would call tolerance a toxic trait that I think I mentioned in the beginning a little bit, but people, we're all fooled by the idea of tolerance, and we all think, it's hard to think that it's not good. You know, it's very difficult to say, well, to be tolerant is a bad thing, because it's not always bad, and to be tolerant with your in-group or among your friends or among your family, up to a point, you know, we all have to tolerate a lot of things in this world, and you can't be jumping on the people around you just because they're doing something you don't like. But when we bring it into a higher, more all-encompassing area, when we say that as a nation, we have to be tolerant of people from other nations, and well, the tolerance has just gone to a ridiculous extreme in the new society that we're in here, and it's all in order to weaken the white nations as white and bring in lots of non-whites in there, and to weaken white people generally. That's pretty clear. So that's where the tolerance is an evil. We have to be able to say, I'm not going to be tolerant. I'm not tolerant of any of this, and I don't have to be tolerant. And at the same time, the people who are promoting this tolerance are not doing it for our good, but for their good. So in this way, and today it's being used more than ever, because the whole thing about anti-Semitism, which they talk about all the time, it's all based on the need to be tolerant, as though anything other than tolerance is absolutely unacceptable. You know, in every case, in every instance, you must be tolerant. Even if somebody's doing something to harm you, well, you would want to stop them from doing it. You can call the police or something. But you're still expected to be tolerant in the sense that, well, they can't help themselves or they've got reasons or they've got problems. And, you know, I have this understanding of what they're doing, even though it's harming you. All right, ladies and gentlemen, this has been quite a show here. So I'm going to say good night for now. I'm going to have a 5-year anniversary show next Monday. So do remember to tune in for that, and I will see you then. Good night for now. This is Carolyn Yeager on the Heretics Hour on February 23rd, 2015.